Due to the global outbreak of the coronavirus, the Voice of America is taking every necessary precaution to safeguard its employees, so our broadcast will look a little different today and in the near future as we reduce our staffing at VOA headquarters here in Washington. We appreciate your staying with us on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, you're welcome to Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. Today, it's a conversation on the struggle against racism in the United States. My distinguished guests are Malaina Montgomery, the Manager Education Abroad Program at Howard University, and Melvin Foote, President of the Constituency for Africa. I have to say, Malaina and Melvin, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's always great to be with you, Shaka.
It's always a pleasure to host you, Melvin, and it's been, in fact, a very, very long time since you last graced our VOA studios.
Yeah, I thought I was a political refugee and you pushed me out. You know, you don't like what I had to say.
Not really.
It's good to be back.
not really. I have to say that when it comes to censorship, I happen to be that guy that would probably be eminently underqualified for the role. Yeah, let's begin with Malaina. Malaina, in the spirit of the topic of today, what exactly do we mean by the struggle against racism in the United States of America?
Well, thank you, Mr. Shaka, for having me and to the production staff. It's really a pleasure to be having this conversation with my colleagues here in the U.S. and also speaking to those who are located across the African diaspora. This is a very important topic. And the struggle that we as people of color, Black people especially, are facing is related to an ongoing fight that our parents, our grandparents, our great-great-parents, grandparents have been working on, and that's to fight against this racialized American system and economy. And so today what we're seeing is it all coming to a head, and everyone who has been subject to the oppression of the system is now feeling as though there's nothing to do. And so this is where the protesting comes, and this is where the collective movement to demand for more is really stemming from this historical system of oppression.
Now, Melvin, what about you? Someone might say, wait a minute. Your people are here for more than 400 years. We're talking about more than four centuries here, for those who really care about history. And therefore, one would frankly have thought that you have legitimate shares in this republic called the United States of America, whose constitution that was once perhaps the most progressive document says that all men are created equal. How could you then continue fighting against racism? Against who? Yeah. This is your country.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's not just, first of all, it's not just the United States. This is a global fight. And when you look at colonialism in Africa, you know, Africans are still fighting for their own continent, you know. And so I think this is a global fight, honestly. And when I look at it and say, okay, here in the United States, we're up against a system of racism. We're up against a system of white supremacy. You know, the country was built on the thought that white people are right people and Black people are beasts of burden. They put it in the scripture. They put it in every aspect of American society. So we look at these statues that are being taken down one by one, and here they are honoring white slave masters, and, you know, people who treated us like animals, you know. And so the fight that we're fighting is not a new fight. This fight has been going on, like you said, for 400 years in this country, and it's going to go on for a long time. You know, so I think, you know, what we're seeing now is people are finally waking up to the reality of it. A lot of people are surprised that we are here. We thought that with Barack Obama as president, that the racism was solved. We, you know, we thought we had overcome. We thought Martin Luther King was smiling. But what we saw, what we now realize is that for many white people in this country, that was the rally cry. We're never going to allow this to happen again. So that's what we're up against. We're up against history. We're up against a system of oppression. We're up against you know, racism that has been inculcated in every aspect of American society.
Yes, indeed. Malena, another skeptic might actually say, wait a minute again. You have a country which embraced one African American, Barack Obama, as its president for two terms, not one term, two terms of 8 years. Barack Obama and his wife, Michelle Obama, the first lady, were the occupants of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. You also have the only statue or the only incredible monument at the mall in Washington, D.C., of someone who was never president, but that person, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who is regarded by some as the conscience of America, happened to be an African-American, a black man. How does that happen in a country, in a society that you seem to depict as quote-unquote racist?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great question. And I think because we're really only able to recognize two black men in the history of this country that have been given a platform of respect and power. So as you mentioned, President Barack Obama and the Dr. Martin Luther King are two black men who have been given a sense of pride and privilege and power within the context of the U.S. And there have been hundreds more and plenty of more who have tried to take on leadership positions that were never given that same level of respect or serious appreciation. And so I think that in itself is a representation of how the system undervalues black voices, black excellence, and black people. So we have these two models, but we have over 400, 500 years now of doing this, which so many other of our leaders have been taken down and have been just made to be in a position where our communities are not supported because we don't have the representation that, for example, Malcolm X may have offered. And that's just to mention one more black man, but there are plenty of black women as well who are working hard now and have been working hard historically to fight this country. And again, they're not allowed as to be supported and to be placed in positions where we can be visible and seen as role models for one another.
Now, Melvin, I remember during one of the editions of Shaka Extra Time, I remember a question from an African lady who was wondering what you are complaining about, because in her particular case, she was ready to switch positions. She was ready to cede her citizenship in one of the African countries on the continent and to come to America. And her argument was, in America, you are free as far as you're concerned. She said, for example, you have had not one, but two secretaries of state in the United States of America. You have had a black man as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a top American soldier, who, of course, as you know, eventually also managed to become the top American diplomat. How do you convince that skeptical lady in Africa that you are not serious, you are not suffering, that in fact she would like to trade places with you?
That's a good point, Shaka. The reality is that Africans in America are the wealthiest blacks in the world. You know, we're the best educated. We have more food. We have access to water. We have political freedom that you don't find most places around the world. So on the one hand, you look at these African Americans, and you know the biggest problem we have is obesity. You know, we have problems of too much food. We got problems of don't know what to do with our time, you know, so we buy stuff frivolously. It's a two-sided coin here. On the one side, you look at African-Americans, and we are suffering. We've suffered from the time we've gotten to this country. But on the other hand, this is the wealthiest country in the world, the biggest economy of the world. And so we as African-Americans are also beneficiaries of that. So the question is, should we be satisfied with our second-class status here in this country, or should we be trying to stand on the values of the forefathers of the Constitution, that all men and women are created equal, you know, endowed with certain inalienable rights, and all of this stuff is in our Constitution. So part of this is the fight for, justice and fairness here in this country under this system. Now, having said that, if you go to parts of Africa and you're looking at issues of whether or not you're going to eat today, and then you juxtapose that with the life of blacks in America, it doesn't really relate. So that's why I think that the strategy has got to be global. I'm looking at Africa and saying, okay, a lot of the problems Africans got is because white people want their resources. They want the diamonds, they want the gold, they want the coltan. And they believe that they're endowed with global resources, and resources of black people are their resources too. So it's a complicated battle, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm. How do you respond, Malaina, to some in Africa, some of your cultural cousins in Africa, who say, for example, that when you tell them about this thing called democracy, social, economic, political justice, as some would call it, that it is not something you can really eat. They are rather comfortable more with what is considered to be basically service delivery, as opposed to this concept. They say they cannot eat. And they say that largely because their presidents, their leaders or rulers, some might call them, in fact, ask them whether you can actually eat democracy rather than at least have unfettered access to health care, for example, have access to clean drinking water, have access to some food in your stomach.
I would tell folks who are listening on the continent who believe that the U.S. is a democratic system that works in favor of all of its people that it's just simply not a dream actualized. And the reality here is that black people in the U.S. lack an access to all of the daily necessities at the quality at which they exist here in this country. So though we may not be thirsty for water or in need of housing, What we are in need of is access to equal opportunities to have resources within our community. I have a point that the president made, that the quality of the food that we are receiving in our community is so low that that's leading to obesity. That's leading to the health problems that inevitably cause the increase in the death rate of Black people here in the U.S. And so it's a different type of manipulation that we're facing in this country that's different from in Africa, but the ultimate end result is still that we are being subjugated as people, and we are being told that we're less than simply because of the color of our skin. And so when we look at land and property ownership, it's very difficult for Black people to purchase property, and especially purchase property in communities that aren't food deserts, that are safe, that are clean, that have access to great education. These are things that just aren't realities for us easily. There are those who have managed to work very hard and to be a part of the system, the capitalist system in which they're able to gain money to buy the large homes outside of Black communities and be a part of majority white communities and therefore access education and access, again, security and the food. But even there, their position is on the table. They're seen as being different from those who make up the majority of those around them. So I would say the struggles on Impact Plus are different in one way from the struggles on the continent, but at the end of the day, they still come down to greater powers or greater systems, and in this case, the democratic system, being in a position to tell those who are Black skin or brown skin that their well-being, their quality of life is less valuable than those who are in the 1% and 2% to control the system.
Chuck, I'd like to add to that, if I can. You know, one look at how did these Black people in America get here? And we came here as the beast of burden. They were brought here as slaves, starting with the Angolans who came through Hampton. You know, and so, okay, the Blacks were brought here purely to work, to clear the land, to help build the buildings, to provide the labor to build this country. And, you know, you look at everything from the White House to the Congress, Black people built them, and we did it without payment. I mean, this was, we were basically like a horse or a donkey or a sheep. Now, on top of that, the Black people who were brought here, many of the women were raped, you know, and so all of us who are African Americans have some white heritage, you know, from the slavery experience. And so you got all kinds of color schemes. They took away their names. They took away their drums. They took away everything that was perceived as African, and we became something else. Some call us Negroes. Some call us colored. So, you know, among white people, they're looking at us, and they're seeing people with Irish ancestry, Italian ancestry, you know. And so who are we as African Americans? So some of them want to make us subhuman. You know, it was amazing what they did with even the children of these women who were raped. Thomas Jefferson, you know, Black children, you know, but he did not accept them as his. They were always held to something else. The laws were changed that these children of even white slave masters were treated as slaves, you know, and so that has been perpetuated going forward. And, you know, the white society did not want to accept these people as neighbors. They did not want to accept these people as someone they could go to school with or socialize with. And this is the battle that we've been fighting really for 400 years. Who are we? We're not quite African per se. We don't have the language. We don't have the culture. Many of us that don't have even an understanding of what is Africa. but we're not American either, in the sense that we're not white, you know? So who are we? We're caught in between being an African and being an American. We're neither an African nor are we American. So that's the complex situation we're in.
You know, Mayor, it is interesting that you alluded to what you characterized as they took away their names. I am reminded, in fact, of a classic written by the late, great Alex Haley. Mm-hmm. We're talking about roots here. And I'm talking about a scene where a character called Kunta Kinte is being caned because he is not accepting to be called Toby. Mm-hmm. Is that something you're alluding to?
Absolutely, 100%. Mm-hmm. And they don't want us to be reaching back to Africa, to wanting to go back to Africa. They don't want it. They want us to be satisfied to stay here and work as slaves, unpaid, you know, owned by somebody else. So they gave us the name of the slave master, you know. My name is Foot, which is a German name, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a hard thing. And so you look at a lot of the problems of African Americans, they're tied to the fact we don't know who we are. It's tied to this psychological, how do we accept who we are in this world? Who are we? So a lot of us are trying to reach back to Africa. We're trying to take on an African identity. We're trying to understand Africa because we see ourselves as an African people. But on the other hand, we're not. You know, we don't have the links to the village. We don't have the understanding of the deep culture of Africa because that was taken from us. We have the black skin, so we know we are African-derived, but are we African or are we American, or what does that mean? That is the ultimate paradox that we find ourselves in.
I think as far as some very important African players are concerned, you remain African. Yeah. It was, in fact, the Ghanaian founding president, mm-hmm. Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, who once said that he was not an African simply because he was born in Africa, but rather that he was an African because Africa was born inside him.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, one of the pioneering African-American intellectuals, Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, not only was he one of the mentors of Kwame Nkrumah, but the last time I checked, when you go to the Ghanaian capital, Accra, that's where you find the grave, the tomb of W.E.B. Du Bois, which has since been transformed into a sort of cultural center, the W.E.B. Du Bois Center.
I think today, Black people in the U.S., we're still working to find an ownership and to really raise our feelings of value as Black identity. And I think just to the point of naming, even though our last names may be those of, you know, European slaveholders and have an origin in that history, a lot of our first names tell a story of resilience and strength and pride to our community. So, example, my name is Marina. Marina is the combination of my two grandmothers, Margaret and Lorraine.
Yes.
And this is one example of a name, a strong Black name in which the creativity of our family have come together to give us something of strength, knowing that we have to navigate this world as Black people. And so I do have to acknowledge that there is so much that has been taken from us, but that as African Americans, we have so much culture and resilience and strength because of the experiences that we come with. But I will say, kind of in relation to all of this conversation, racism in the U.S. affects all of us as Black people, especially because every single day, no matter we are, no matter what we're doing, no matter what we're wearing, what our hair looks like, we are made to remember and feel that we are Black. And therefore, there's something that is different about us. And so that type of emotional weight that we carry here in the U.S. is very different from anywhere else in the world. And so in Africa, when Black people are the majority, there's a capacity to think more broadly about all of the other opportunities in life, all of the other experiences in life. Whereas here, our Black identity, the lens through which we see everything, and therefore we're always questioning whether what we're doing is in the way that we need to be, or if it's being judged by external factors that relate to this idea of us being different from them.
Melvin, let's walk a bit back to where you said or observed that, or rather told us a little bit the story about how you were forcibly brought here across the Atlantic. That was a long time ago. And in fact, initially, it was during the British colonialism. But later, this republic that called itself the United States of America got its political independence. And it got its political independence on the basis of a very important and at one time known as a progressive document, which was the Constitution. How were your people factored into that important document? Were they factored as people? Were they factored from what I saw, from what I read, as two-fifths of a person, a human being, or as a property? How were your people factored in this constitution?
I think we were factored as property. You know, I think we were factored as a cow or a horse or a donkey or any other kind of animal that you have, you see on the farm. I mean, we were owned by people. I mean, we were owned by people. The early slaves in the United States were actually Indians. And, the white man thought that, get the Indians to do this work. But the Indians could easily walk or run away and they can't find them, you know. And that's where the idea came to bring Africans. I mean, this blackness of the skin, where are they going to run to, you know? They can't swim across the ocean. Where are they going to run to? And so one of the reasons that Africans became preferred as slaves was the fact that there were no place for us to go. And plus, they needed some of the grow rice in the Carolinas. So they found out that the people in Sierra Leone and some of these West African countries grew rice. So they brought expertise with them. So we were brought here as commodity. Everybody knows about the Middle Passage. That struggle has been I live and eat and breathe Africa every day. I live in an African world. You know, I've always lived in an African world. And even if I'm among white people, I'm still very much in an African world. I'm thinking, eating, you know. I think back at the time when Blacks were first struggling for freedom and equality here, they went to the white church, the Episcopalian church. And of course, the Blacks were not admitted into the Episcopalian church. What did they do? They established the African Methodist Episcopal Church, Africa. This goes back to the 1700s, 1800s. The same thing is true of other institutions that go back where African Americans were really trying to reach back to their Africanness. And of course, it gets into the Marcus Garvey period and the back to Africa because we weren't getting dignity over here. It was clear we were not going to be treated as human beings over here. And so, the struggle has been legal. It's been economic. After the emancipation, the Lincoln signed the emancipation, we thought the African people here would become free, you know. But then the other game came, how do we exploit these African people? And it gets into Jim Crow. I mean, the struggle has continued. There's a clear line of a continuation of the struggle. And so what we see today is nothing more been a continuation of the struggle. And if we don't organize ourselves, if we spend our time agonizing, we're not going to get anywhere. So we have to, rather than agonize, we have to organize, you know. And it's clear to me that this is intergenerational. Those of us of age, we have to spend our time now working on this next generation, making sure that they're ready to continue the struggle. I was down at the protest in front of the White House, even on the first day of it, it was amazing to me. You looked at the people who were there. They were 25 and young. They were Howard University students. You know, these were young people. Not only black young people, white young people. You know, there were women in baby carriages. These were not the old grizzly civil rights strugglers. These were not Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton. These were 20-year-olds, 23-year-olds who were clear to me that they understood where we came from and they understand where we're going. So I'm quite confident that the next generation is going to be prepared to continue the struggle, but it's going to be a struggle. You know, it's not going to be handed to you. It's not going to be, fairness is not going to be dealt out. You know, we're going to have to struggle legally and otherwise to get to where we want to go. And it's going to be hundreds of years. There's nothing short about this at all. This is going to be a long-term struggle.
Time is not our best ally, so we will go for a break, and when we come back, we shall continue our discussion. So please, don't go away.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. Every week, connect with our experts. You can ask them your questions and get their advice. Join me, Lino Mudu, in Washington on Healthy Living, your new health program, right here on Voice of America.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa. Coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. And our topic today is the struggle against racism in the United States of America. And my distinguished guests are Malaina Montgomery, the Manager Education Abroad Program at Howard University, and Melvin Foote, President of the Constituency for Africa. Melvin, you mentioned something interesting. You mentioned the words or the concept of Jim Crow. Who was Jim Crow, or what was Jim Crow?
Well, there's a couple aspects. One of them is a guy named Willie Lynch. And Willie Lynch was a slave consultant. You know, he would go around to the plantations and consult the plantation owners. How do you get more productivity out of your slaves? How do you make your slaves better slaves? And yeah, he talked about the fact that you had to divide them up. You had to fragment them. You had to pit one against the other. You had to pit the light skin against the dark skin. You pit the women against the men. This divide and conquer is the best way to keep these slaves under control. And sure enough, he said, if you do it right, it'll last 100 years, 200 years, or forever. You know, it'll continue as part of their culture. And sure enough, that's true. So when you get into Jim Crow was the answer to the emancipation of the slaves. The slaves are free once they signed the document. We didn't know what that freedom meant, you know. You were free, but you were not given any resources to be free. You know, we talked about the 40 acres and a mule that each slave was supposed to get. We never got that, you know. At least to get started here in America. And so Jim Crow was, what it meant was that we're going to have slavery without having slavery, without being on the books. We're still going to have slavery. We're going to still have free labor from the blacks, or very highly exploited labor of the blacks in the cotton fields and so forth. And it became a series of codes and otherwise the police are part of this whole equation. You know, the police were set up really not to look for crime. They were set up to check the slaves, you know, to find the slaves, the ones who are, you know, breaking away from the plantation. We hired a police force to go and look for them. And this has been manifested in what we see today and in terms of Black Lives Matter, you know? You're going to get me in trouble, Shaka.
No, we won't get in trouble, but I think that we have a responsibility at least to be informative and to be educative for that matter. What about somebody in the audience who may not really be familiar with the concept of Jim Crow? How would you, for example, compare and contrast something that that particular audience might have been familiar with, for example, apartheid in South Africa, or Karaba in Algeria, in Kenya, and in what used to be Rhodesia? We're talking about Zimbabwe and Zambia. Any comparisons between Jim Crow and apartheid or Karaba?
I think it's an exact comparison. I mean, you're talking about two sides of the same coin. Apartheid, was rigid, and but it was not any worse per se than the Jim Crow period here in the United States. And when I first went to South Africa, after Mandela became free and took over the presidency, the South African could learn a lot from the African American experience, and vice versa. We could learn a lot from the South African experience. We're fighting the same battle, and we call it different names, and different people involved in it, but it involved dehumanizing the black people in order to exploit their natural resources and to exploit their labor, And whether you call it Jim Crow or whether you call it apartheid, it's the same. It's the same thing.
Very interesting, Malaina. How did you then, your people, how did they negotiate their way from the Jim Crow type of conditions to where we are? We're talking, of course, about the civil rights struggle. We're talking about here the struggle, frankly, for being a legitimate citizen that had the full rights of what the Constitution provided for. How did you negotiate your way from the type of property that the Constitution considered you to becoming a legitimate American citizen with a vote, that you could in fact vote for somebody to be president of the United States of America, vote for your senator, for your congressman or congresswoman? How did you negotiate that?
So negotiation is a word that I would say describe lightly. In fact, I would say that a better word is we fought. Black people have been fighting in this country since we arrived, and we fought for everything that we have. If we look at, and we sacrificed ourselves as individuals for the collective good of our people. So there have been leaders that knew that eventually they would be taken down because of their strength and their voice, but still continue to fight nonetheless because they knew that it was pushing the needle forward for the collective. And I mean, if we talk about politics, Shirley Chisholm, first African-American woman to run officially for the president of the United States, she was an example. She created a path and a model for the possibility that I would argue Barack Obama had to recognize in his efforts to become president. And so there are countless individuals like Shirley Chisholm who have been the first to show that we can and we should continue to fight, and then to also prove that if we're taken down, that the system is stacked up against us, we really have nothing to continue to fight. So it hasn't been a negotiation, it's been an ongoing struggle in which for generations our parents, our grandparents have shared their with their children, and therefore created this energy and this sense of determination. That's another key word, determination, to do better than the generation that preceded them, knowing that it's unfair, the system is stacked against us, and all we can do is fight. But as we continue to fight each generation after the next, we'll eventually get to a place where equality and social justice is something that our future generations can live with. But it will only come through fighting, and the protesting that we're seeing right now is exactly that.
the protests that we are seeing right now. But these protests happen to be guaranteed by the Constitution.
The freedom of speech, exactly. And so we're utilizing that as another valid point. There are systems in which the right to protest, the right to be in conflict with the government and the status quo is illegal, and people are killed because of that or imprisoned because of creating those actions. And so we're using the tools of the master's house to, in effect, work to dissemble it, as has been said. But what I understand and what I think these protests of today show us is that we, as those who have been oppressed, cannot and should not be the only ones working to fight against the injustices that we face. There are so many of us who are tired. There are so many Black people who have devoted their entire existence. I would argue the majority of Black people have forcefully devoted their entire existence to one cause or another that seeks to uplift and support the collective global Black community. And so as a result, we need, and I think it's important that allies, non-Black, non-brown allies, understand it's their responsibility. They can see, and especially now when everybody is kept indoors because of the pandemic, they can see through video, through film, through testimony, through the anger, through the fear, through the pain, that the system is unjust, and for them to stand around and silence is to be complicit and to support it. And so now, because they've had so many years of privilege and luxury to enjoy the fruits of all of our labor, they have the strength to get out there and support on our behalf and alongside of us. We're never going to stop fighting. Well, now we need everyone to be a part of that collective movement to social justice.
You know, Melvin, the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once observed that protests, and I might add riots, are the language of the unheard. Do you agree with him?
I absolutely agree with him. You know, last year I decided to go down south. Most of us who grew up in the north, I grew up in Rockford, Illinois. I'm at home now. We came during the Great Migration. We were being chased out of the South. We were being hung. Thousands of Black people were hung in the South simply because they refused to get off the sidewalk, or simply because they might have said something to the boss that they didn't want to hear, and they were hung by the neck. So I took a trip by car through Georgia, through Alabama, through Mississippi, up to Tennessee. It was eye-opening. I had run into Congressman John Lewis before making the trip. John is out of out of Montgomery area. I told John I'm going to go down south to get a sense of what went on. He said, "Man, come and see me when you come back. You're going to see a lot." And I saw a lot. So when you look at the movement of the civil rights struggle, when I think about Rosa Parks, a little small, frail woman who refused to give up her seat on the bus because she put the same amount of money into the till as anybody else. And wow, you know, where did you get the courage to take on that battle? I mean, I came away from my trip down south with tears in my eyes. And I think, you know, we talk about these statues being taken down. We need to put statues up for John Lewis, for Rosa Parks, for Fannie Lou Hamer, for Medgar Evers. The struggle that they took on, I crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which goes between Selma and Montgomery. And man, I mean, just brought tears to your eyes to know that you're going to get beaten by clubs, you're going to get bitten by dogs, but still, you know, going to sing the songs, going to praise the Lord, and talk about redemption. I'd rather be in my grave than to be a slave, you know? So I have nothing but love and respect for those who struggled. And I think it's incumbent upon us now to continue the struggle. And what I'm seeing out here now is it's not just black people. Everybody saw George Floyd getting murdered on TV. It was seen across the world on social media. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to know that this man was murdered by the police. Murdered. I mean, not accidental, not resisting arrest, murdered. And so I think that a lot of white people also saw that murder. And these young people are saying, wait a minute, you know, I may not agree with some of the things that are going on, but I do understand a murder when I see it in my own eyes. So that's where we are as a country. I think that no struggle, no progress. I think that, you know, we'll find ourselves in a better place. We'll find ourselves with a better country, you know, with a better respect for all Americans, black, white, Hispanic, gay, lesbian. It doesn't matter. You know, if you subscribe to the Constitution and you are a legitimate American, you should be entitled to certain inalienable rights. All of this stuff is written down in our big documents, our Constitution. All we're asking is that the country live up to its creed. You know, the reality of this country is that we murdered the Indian populations to move them off the land. You know, we started out in the wrong way. You know, Christopher Columbus discovered America when there were millions of Indians already living here. How do you discover something when people are already living here? So I think that the country has a lot. We're still a very much a young country. This is not an old country. We have a lot to learn about who we are as a country and who we are as a humanity.
You know, when you talk about Christopher Columbus discovering America, I am reminded of the aspect of history which is called historiography, different interpretations of history. Some scholars will probably tell you that the better characterization of Christopher Columbus and his activities would come under the first European to see the land that later was called America. What about that?
I agree. I mean, you know, the history is his story, and they sure have written their his story. And you look at it and you say, what? What? You know, what they teach you about slavery and the kids growing up, they teach them that slavery was almost a willing kind of an activity. We were happy to be slaves. You know, we never lived so good as the time when we were slaves. And some would tell you that's the time we were organized. And, you know, even they got black Americans to say that. When I see some of these people out there who are black, who have been so conditioned to accept this.
It is interesting because when I was an undergraduate student in New York in the late 1970s, I remember an interview on ABC News conducted by David Frost, interviewing a former U.S. President, Richard Nixon, and putting a question to him, how did Richard Nixon feel that history would treat him? And President Nixon responded that if you want history to be favorable to you, either you have to write it yourself or you commission someone to do it on your behalf.
Yeah.
And across the Atlantic, a former great British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, asked the same question. Also responded that luckily he was a good writer and therefore he was going to write it himself. Very interesting.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I know that there are several indigenous tribes that believe that anything written is not trusted. And so it's to the same point that if someone is writing it, it's flowing through their interpretation of the situation and therefore it's biased.
Yeah. Interesting. Now, Melvin mentioned George Floyd, the man that was allegedly slain in Minneapolis, Minnesota, live on video. That event has triggered what has now come to be known as Black Lives Matter too, correct?
Well, I think it's reinvigorated the Black Lives Matter
movement. Yeah.
Okay.
It was long established before that of many names, but I think it was Trayvon Martin or
let me put it this way then. That ugly event has reinvigorated Black Lives Matter.
Absolutely.
A movement, by the way, at least according to several public opinion polls that I have seen, is favored by a majority of the Americans. And yet, the President of the United States of America, Donald J. Trump, has recently, if I recall correctly, characterized it as a symbol of hatred. How do you react to that? If correct, how do you react to that?
I react to it with pity for the powers that are governing this country, because it is, she is doing what she has done from the beginning, and that's to seek ways to divide the country. I think the name in itself, Black Lives Matter, is a very diplomatic way of the Black community telling the world that we are here and we deserve to live and we deserve equity and justice. It's not saying what the slogans of the past have said, Black Power. It's a very diplomatic way of rallying an entire community, an entire global community, behind a simple message that states that Black people are significant, are human, and deserve to not be killed, not to be overseen, and to not be criminalized and demonized in any context, but especially in the context of the United States. So I think it's very decisive and it's very politically minded for our president to call the Black Lives Matter movement unpatriotic. I think it's the most patriotic movement that we currently have at the moment, and it's the one that is unifying this country in a way that we've never seen, or that we haven't seen in quite a long time.
If I could add to that, you know, we have a presidential election coming up in November. And of course, President Trump is seeking re-election against Joe Biden. And, you know, so they're looking at their polling number. They're looking at how do they return to office in the context of the greatest public health tragedy of our lifetime. 140,000 people have died in this country from the coronavirus, and clearly it was poorly managed, if not managed at all. You know, you're looking at the numbers in Europe and other parts of the world have gone down dramatically, but here in the United States, those numbers have gone up. Who's to blame? I mean, one of the questions that voters are going to have to ask themselves as we move to the polls is, are you better off now than you was 4 years ago? You know? They always ask that question. Are you better off now than you was 4 years ago? Now, who's going to stand up and say, oh, no, I'm better off now, you know, when our people are dying at a record pace? At the same time, you're looking at the issues of culture. You're looking at, you know, this country wants to move ahead. People want to move ahead and said, okay, I get it. Black Lives Matter, you know. We shouldn't be out here killing Black people for no reason. We shouldn't be demeaning brown people for no reason. You know, so this is going to be the test of whether this country goes forward or goes backward. You know, it's going to be a very interesting election. The president seemed to be trying to keep people from going to the polls or registering their vote, you know, because he knows those people are going to vote against him. And so he wants to stack the numbers up so that at the end of the day, he remains the president of the United States. He's also faced with a lot of legal issues that he knows once he leaves power, Nancy Pelosi and Maxine Waters and the rest are going to come for him.
What would you say is the relationship between Black Lives Matter and Black Power? I talk about Black Power specifically because I first came across it back in 1968, Mexico City Olympics, where some of the world's fastest athletes were my African-American cousins. But probably in that most important memorable picture of the clenched fists signaling Black Power, or the beginning of Black Power, really. I remember the pictures of Tommy Smith, John Carlos, and the third one was probably Lee Evans. What is the difference between now and then?
The Black Power fist in itself is symbolic of resilience and a determination to fight. And so it's a very strong phrase with a strong image that tells the world that Black people are overcoming, we're achieving, we're fighting, we're excelling, despite all of the odds that are stacked against us. It's power. Again, back to the Black Lives Matter movement, that's diplomatic. So we've had the movement in the past that told the world that we matter, that have told the world that we're fighting and we're excelling. And I think the movement of today has learned from movements of the past and is incorporating that same energy, but has changed the branding to be more inclusive of everyone, knowing that this is a collective fight.
What about you, Melvin?
I remember most about the Black Power movement was James Brown, when he said, he came out with a song saying, "Say it loud, I'm Black and I'm proud."
Yes.
And every one of us within the street say it loud, "I'm Black and I'm proud."
Yes.
It's a rally cry. And I think that the Black Lives Matter, they picked up on today's social movement. You know, we got Instagram, we got Facebook, we got, instant communication.
When do we need it? Now or yesterday?
Now!
Well, on that note, our distinguished guests were Malaina Montgomery and Melvin Foote.
The Black Lives Matter.
That's right. Say it loud.
And for that, get better, not better, the African diaspora. And please, please remember to keep the African hopes alive. Thank you.